There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking with blues great Bobby Rush, who's won numerous blues awards, and his latest album, Rawer Than Raw, from Deep Rush Records, has been nominated for a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Album. We'll talk about that new long player, and Bobby will also share a lot of stories about his career, his friendship with blues legends like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Little Walter, his life on the road, and his experiences on set during the making of Eddie Murphy's Dolomite Is My Name. First, though, we'll set the stage with a floor filler that Bobby released in 1967, Sock Boogaloo, followed by our Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Come on, everybody, got something for you to do.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for our Coolest Conversations. And joining me is blues musician, composer, and singer Bobby Rush. Began his career as a teen. He's currently 87, and his most recent album is last year's Rawer Than Raw, which has been nominated for a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Album. And he's won numerous other blues awards over the years as well. Hey, Bobby, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. So glad to be with you guys. So honored that you invited me.
Absolutely. So happy to have you. Man, it's a crazy time, obviously. Have you and your family and friends been able to stay healthy over this past year?
Man, in February, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I did a show there in Nashville, Tennessee, with an Nelson, who I respect and love so much, and I had planned to meet him to talk about a few things, and didn't chance to do it because I got sick. Didn't know, I thought I just had a bad cold, and 29th of February, I came home on that Sunday, which by the first, I was just out of it, man. My son, who was a policeman here in Jackson, Mississippi, taking me to the hospital and to the emergency room. And I had 105 temperature.
Wow.
So they rushed me in that and tried to put some ice and water on me, get my temperature down. They put me in a room, me being a blues singer and a black man who's 80 some odd years old. And I heard him say through the door, said, put him in room number three, whatever that means. When I look back on it now, that means number three, I'm a guy who's probably won't live. And I'm black and I'm old too, you know, and didn't know what was wrong. So they say he probably got the COVID. So I didn't know what that meant at the time, because at that time, Mississippi didn't have any disease and the virus as much as they have now. And they still don't have that much. So, but several hours, I got sick and sick and sick. So my friend, Dr. Smith, is my friend. He's my doctor also. Mm-hmm. He said, man, said, I think you have the bug. I got to get you out of here. So I had my temperature is 105. He's checking now. So the 103. Got it down to 101. So when I got it to the 100, he said, I got to get you out of here and go home, because what you have, probably more of it in the hospital than in the place. So I came home, and my family nursed me back to health, and God had his hedge around me. For about a week later, then my fever started breaking. I mean, I got down to normal in about 8 days. but I was out of it. Let me show you how out I was, because 4 or 5 days after I got home, I told my son, I said, man, listen, I was sick in a dog 2 or 3 days ago, and I'm doing good now. He said, Daddy, 2 or 3 days ago, he says, that was a week ago. I had lost track of everything because the fever. God had his hedge around me.
Well, Bobby, and I'm sorry that you had to suffer through that. Have you had felt any, you know, has it lingered at all, or is this?
No, I haven't, man, I look out every night for me a moon when I can see it, because I want to try to jump over it. That's how good I feel, you know? I know I feel good. I'm blessed. I'm so blessed, man. You know, when I think about what it was, what it is, I think about what it could be. I'm so thankful for what it is.
Right. And so you call Jackson, Mississippi, these days?
I call Jackson home now, because I've been here 20-something years now, 25 years or better.
Originally, you're from North Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. I left my hometown in 1947, went to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. In 1949, I met Elmo James and Muddy Waters. And I met Willie Dixon, Little Walter, and John Lee Hooker. And they invited me to come to Memphis, where they were playing. So I didn't have any money to go to Chicago. So that was a good way for me to get to Memphis so I could make a little money. When I got to Memphis, I met B.B. King, who was in Helena, Arkansas. Him and Sonny Boy Williamson gave me a little work, and I worked on Beale Street, made me a little money. Then I went to St. Louis, where Chuck Berry and Albert King was. So I worked there for a couple of weeks, and I made enough money to get myself to Chicago, where Willie Dixon and our Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf were living. Howlin' Wolf, at that time, moved back to Clarksville, Mississippi, he and Ike Turner, and that's kind of the life of me. Then I got hooked up with Jimmy Reed, Smokey Hall, and Big Joe Turner, and all the guys, and Bo Dylan, and all of my friends, man. And I think about that, and I laugh, because it was good knowing these guys, but you know, I'm about the oldest guy left now. The guy next to me would be Buddy Guy.
Early on, was it your father that taught you how to play harmonica?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, yeah. My dad, man, was a preacher and a pastor of 2 churches. And when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my cousin gave me this guitar. And I hid it in a loft, because my daddy being a preacher, my thought was, I got to hide this guitar because I don't want to play gospel. I don't want to play in the choir. I don't want to do anything spiritually. I want to play the blues, because that's what I love. And I used to listen to WLAC radio station lots. And this is what I was hearing the blues from. So I hid this guitar so my daddy wouldn't see it. So one day he said, I'm a junior. I'm named after my father. He said, Junior, come here, boy. I said, yes, sir. He said, bring the guitar here. God, I was afraid, because I thought he was going to throw it away or either scold me about having it. He said, let me play a song to your boy. I used to play for a little girl when I was a little older than you. Well, I got close to his leg because I was wanting to hear the song, because I figured it was going to be glory, glory, hallelujah. Yeah. And I laid my breath, either about my mom.
Yeah.
It wasn't either one of them. He said, me and my gal went to Chanky Pen hunting. She fell down and I saw something. I said, man, and a preacher. I said, sing it again. Now, what I wanted my dad to do, to sing the other verse. Now, I know the first verse, this lady fell down. He saw something. I figured the next verse, he'd tell me what he saw. Now, I want to hear that. You know, boy, I want to hear that. But I couldn't ask my daddy what he saw. You know, at my age, my daddy preached it too. I said, Daddy, sing it again. My mama's in the kitchen cooking. She said, me don't sing that kind of song to that boy. So he went to sing it again. He said, me, my gal, what you checking in, hon? She fell down and I saw something. I said, Dad, my mama was coming up in the back of it. I said, how big was she? She said, oh, big woman, fat, 350-pound boy. I said, what she had on? It's nothing but a dress. Now, in my little mind, fat lady falling down, nothing on but a dress. Man, I could just close my eye. I could just see it.
Was your dad okay with you being a musician?
Yeah, my daddy, you know, I came up in a time where I hear musician entertainers talking about the devil's music. My daddy never spoke to me about the devil music, but he never told me to sing the blues, but he never told me not to. So that was a green light to me.
I heard this story about when you were really young, like a teenager, that you would put on a fake mustache to look older so you'd get and play in the clubs. Is that true?
Oh God, yeah, man. I put my age up. That would me have a lot of birthday, because You know, I came up in a time where I didn't really know how old I was, because for my midwife, they had a record kept in the Bible where I was born in 1933 or 32 or 35 or 1940. Somebody said out of 1940. So I took that and run with it for a while. Because that make me younger. But see, yeah, I would take a match, stretch it, and blow it out real quick. I do about 8 or 10 matches like that. Then the soot off of them, I would make me a Wu Mang shoe, you know. And then I would put my cap on, look at myself in the mirror. I say, oh, yeah. Because at that time, you could go in the club when you're 18. I look like I'm 18. I wasn't about 15, man. Come on.
Yeah. I was wondering if you... You know, you started putting on a fake mustache. Have you had a mustache ever since then?
No, man. I was growing a mustache back in 1954, 55. And I had a mustache on. So Jane Brown came to Chicago, and I was living in Chicago, came in with King Record. He was in a cutting with Sonny Thompson, who just was our A&R man for the record company. He looked at me and said, Bobby Rush, hey, man, you got your mustache on. You look much older than I am. We about the same age. Cut your mustache off. You look younger. Whatever that meant. So I went and cut my mustache off so I could look like Jane Brown. Yeah. So me and him both have our hair kind of pumped up you look like my brother now. You know, and I cut my mustache off for maybe 8 or 10 years because, you know, I had this look and I had this groove. I'm playing the blues, but I had this groove going. So I guess Jane Brown influenced me with that, you know, influence. But then later on, I put it back on, and I think I got it back on because I just wanted it on. I don't know.
So you were talking about going over to Memphis and going up to Chicago, and you're meeting all these greats, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Sonny Boy Williamson, and you cover a lot of these guys on Rawr Than Raw. I saw a clip of you online where you're talking about that Willie Dixon had offered you Hoochie Coochie Man to record first.
Yeah, well, I had wrote a part of Hoochie Coochie because Muddy Waters was such a good friend. Mm-hmm. I was talking about a Hoochie Man being a Hoochie.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Muddy Waters was talking about Hoochie Coochie, talking about somebody who in a juke junk.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a couple lines to it. And so when I went to Willie Dixon, but Willie Dixon was a decent guy and a decent writer, but he couldn't write as good as I thought he could write, but he was a great thief. Willie Dixon would steal, man. He would steal some of the things that Willie Dixon got credit for. You know, I tell it now in this book, I'm talking about, this is the first time I'm talking about this out openly. For some of the things that he they got credit for writing for, he didn't really write it. Because how could you write for a bunch of guys who couldn't read or write? So that means they were bringing the songs to Willie. And Willie was the kind of guy who could read and write, were putting them down and taking credit for them because he knew how to get the publishing and the writer's right to. Mm-hmm. You know, he had that kind of knowledge. But when I come to Willie about the song, he said, oh, no, we can't cut that kind of song. But I heard that same song 2 or 3 months later on Muddy Waters.
You know, all these guys that you were talking about here, all these Chicago blues legends, eventually they're all in Chicago too. If you heard like a knock on the door and you heard a voice on the other side say, hey, Bobby, let me in. I want to jam with you one last time. When you open up that door, who do you want to see? Who's the first guy you would like to see?
Muddy Waters, Lil Walter, or Johnny Hooker.
What would you play?
I would play Boom, 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 Boom. Lil Walter, I would say. That's what I would do.
Oh, man. I didn't know you had a harmonica in your hand.
If I go to church, I got it in my pocket.
All right. That's your musical Bible then right there.
Yeah, huh? Well, that's my pacifier.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to talk about the new album, too, in a moment. But your debut single that I could find, I think it's Someday from 1964. Is that your first record, first single?
No, I got a record called Doody Doo, and I got a record called, I recorded again in 1977. I had a song called Just Be Yourself, mm-hmm. Me, Myself, and I, that I did, I believe at 50. 354, but it didn't go no place. It's just something I did and didn't know what to do and how to do it. Didn't have a record company to do it. But what happened to me, I went to Leonard and Phil Chess. I was invited by Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley invited me there. There was a guy called Mel London, who was a good friend of both of them. I didn't know them that well. This was probably 1953 or something like that, roughly. Okay. And I made a mistake for looking at a pamphlet was on one of them desks. I don't remember which desk it was on. And it says 10 and 208, the union was merging. And I said to Bo Diddley, I said, God, this is going to be great. We black musicians go get represented from a better standpoint now because we have the union emerging, because 1008 was a union that a lot of white musicians was in. 2208 and 10 was Journey. That means it's going to be a bigger power, I thought, for black musicians. And I said, this is going to be good. And Bo Diddley said, what you say, man? I said, it's going to be good. He said, read it again. Now, I'm saying this to you because I don't know what Bo Diddley could read it or not. But anyway, I read it to the guy who was sitting around, just us black guys sitting there. So by that time, one of the Chess brothers walked in and said, where did boys get that information? So Leonard told Phil, say, I got it off your desk. He threw it back to him and said, read it, boy. And he said it and just like that. And I read it to him. It's going to be good for us because they journey. He turned around and told his brother, so we can't use that N-word. That's what he used, because he can read. So I didn't get the contract with Chess, because I could read.
Someday you're going to want me back again. Someday, darling.
The first song I heard of yours is Sock Boogaloo. It was a friend of mine put it on a compilation CD, just Boogaloo stuff, and that came out on Chess.
Yeah, it was on Chess.
Was that a big deal to finally get something on Chess?
Yeah, but I didn't have a contract with Chess. They did it on Chess after the fact, after all that stuff that I recut some stuff in Chess. But most, they kept that master, but most of the stuff, I did cut some stuff at Chess, but most of the stuff I got at Chess, I was able to get the master out of Chess. Uh-huh. Now, I was able to get it out of Chess because they didn't hire me, so I started working downtown in Chicago where there was no black musician working down on Bourbon Street and Rush Street in Chicago. I was one of the few, and in the Playboy Club, I was one of the second one behind the Playboy Club, I think. Dick Gregory was the first black they had at Playboy. But at the time, there was a guy who was in charge, or either own it, named Cesar Capone. I learned later that he was Al Capone's brother. So they knew that I was working for the Capone. So when I walk in to record or do things with Chess, they would say, I could hear them say, here come the Al Capone boy. And they would let me have my way. Because they thought I knew Al Capone. They said, you got any money to pay for this? I said, no, let me talk to my boss. They thought I was talking about Al Capone. So they let me have everything and anything. And I used that to my advantage, man. I was working for the place, Bourbon Street, and said, no color allowed. I was the only black musician in the place. I got the job by hiring three white guys to work for the audition. Once I got the gig, then I brought three black musicians in. So I worked for him for a long time, 5 days a week. Wasn't making them. I was making $7.50 a night at the time. Mm-hmm. Then I got Muddy Waters to come down and do a couple of openings for me, and I was paying Muddy Waters $5.50 a night to do my special guest for me. So I said, now I went to him. I said, contract, I'm going to give you a 2-week notice because I got another gig. He said, oh, fine, boy. So I got this other gig down the street and called Swing Club. When I went to the Swing Club, and he said, hey, boy, you great. I appreciate you giving me a notice. So I went to work for Swing Club. The next week, I got ready to get my little check. The man said, well, go to the office and get your check. I went to the office. He said, I said, where's the office? He said, wait up. There's two doors up the street. But two doors up the street, where I've been getting my check from when I was working for the other man.
Yeah.
When I went up to the office, he was the same man. Turned around, looked at me, said, hey, boy, you're fine. We're going to make money together. You respected me. I didn't even know that it was the same man. So apparently they own everything downtown. there was to tell a story of that. I was going to leave one guy, but I left it right. I told him what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And he said okay to it, not knowing the other club belonged to him too. Probably everything down there belonged to him.
Well, did you get a raise?
No. I'm getting $5. I got a $2.50 raise, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Hey, I want us to talk a moment about your song Chicken Heads. That was a big hit for you, right?
That was a big record, man. Chicken Head was a big record. It was hard for me to cut that record. When I say hard to cut it, I couldn't get anyone to believe in this record. Mm-hmm. Calvin Carter had VJ record. It wasn't VJ record when I met Calvin Carter. It was CJ record. Calvin Carter, there's history on that. Calvin Carter and Vivian Carter were sister and brother.
Right.
They had a record called CJ Records. But in 1952 or 53, she got married to Jimmy out of Gary, Indiana, who had a record shop called Jimmy's Record Shop. Once she got married to Jimmy, then they changed the name to VJ Record with Vivian and Jimmy. That's how the record come about. Calvin told me, said, man, I've been wrong to record you for a long time, but man, you don't got tied up with Don Capone, boy. You don't want to mess with me. Well, I went on and recorded a record. And I said, I got a record. He said, what the name of the record? I said, Chickhead. He called Leo RCLN, who was his business partner, and his business partner was a Jehovah's Witness preacher. Uh-huh. And I said, Chickhead. He said, we can't cut no record like that. That's X-rated, man. We can't cut no record. I didn't know. I'm way ahead of my time. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
I said, Chickhead. I said, no, Chicken Head. He said, oh, yeah, you from down south, man. Y'all eat chicken head down there, don't you? I said, yes, sir. And he laughed. He said, but we got to have a B-side. He said, but first of all, tell me how the record go. I said, Daddy told me on his dying bed, give up your heart, but don't lose your head. You came along, girl, what did I do? I lost my heart, my head too, which had nothing to do with the chicken. He said, well, we got to have a B-side. At that time, you had an A and a B-side. I said, I got the B-side. I said, what's the name of it? That's a Mary Jane. He said, oh, yeah, that's a good one, man. I had a girl did me wrong. Her name was Mary Jane. And I wasn't talking about a girl at all. I was talking about Reefer getting high, you know. So I had me two guys didn't know what I was talking about. I went and did the song, man, and the song went number one. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do with the record at that time. I had Dick Clark, who called me, wanted to manage me, and I signed a contract with him, stayed with him for about 6 months, and I wanted to leave him because he wanted to take me to St. Louis, wake all the houses where a lot of crossed me over, but didn't cross me out, where no black people there. And at the time, I didn't know what I know now. I said, oh, man, I can't see nobody. I can't see no black people here. What is all this about? Pearl Bailey was on the show. She had Pearl Bailey and people like that down in Washington. And just big people at that time. But I didn't know. And then Dick Clark really like, I said, Dick Clark, I said, I can't do this. He said, you can't do it? No problem, man. Get your contract back. No problem. Can you believe that? And I was with Dick Clark as a manager.
Wow.
You know?
I want to stick with Chicken Head for a second here because it got used, which not too long ago, 2007, that movie Black Snake Moan with Samuel L. Jackson. More recently, got used in that HBO series Ballers. I imagine that was a nice payday each time. Were you surprised when the song got used in a movie, or did you have you had songs used in TV and movies before?
No, I was surprised. Didn't know. I'm thankful that it got used in Oh God, man. I never thought it was gonna come to this. I was just doing what I love and
right.
What I knew to do. B.B. King asked me one time. Said Barbara Rush, say you're a great writer and producer. Why don't you do some record on me? Me produce a record on you? He said, man, you're going to make a lot of money one of these days. I'm talking about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I said, me make a lot of money doing what I would do free? You know, I didn't know. I went, because I didn't do it for the money. I did for the love of it, you know.
Daddy told me on his dying day, give up your heart, but don't you lose your head. You come along, girl, what did I do? Lost my heart and my head went too. Lord have mercy.
You appeared in that 2003 documentary Road to Memphis, and then that's when Rolling Stone magazine named you King of the Chitlin Circuit. You were doing about 200 shows a year at the time. There's no touring now, of course, but before the pandemic, how many shows a year were you still doing?
Right at 200. 175 shows for 50 years. because I wasn't making that much money per show, so I had to do a lot of shows to make up for the end of the year.
Right.
But the end of the year, I did pretty well because I did a lot of shows. And of course, now during them time, when I was, I'm talking about 40, 50 years ago, a lot of time you do two shows a night. I used to be in Chicago. I would work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Sometimes I would do four or five clubs. I'd go by this club and do 30 minutes, go by that club. I would jump from one to the other because I was this guy who would brisket myself and Jackie Wilson, man. I had the charisma about me, you know?
Yeah.
Where Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf were famous, but they didn't have that zump thing, man, like swiftness, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And I had the swiftness thing about me. I think Sam Cooke had it. Say I'm better than Sam Cooke, but I was in that same age bracket. Jackie Wilson had it, but I didn't get the records that I needed because I think what hindered me that I had this hookup with the Capone and I had work in Chicago and I didn't reach outside of that work area because I was secured in that area. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to get, I guess maybe I didn't want to lose that, you know? And I hate I did it now because I could have been out there earlier because 1963, Muddy Waters just begged me to come on. God. You know, Muddy Waters was so kind to me and Ray Charles. I remember going to New York on a Broadway show. Ray Charles was on it. Had me open the show up. And then I had this band. I was good at it and playing a top 10 song. So Ray Charles looked at me and said, pat me on the knee. He couldn't see me, but he could feel my knee. So Bobby Rush, what you doing? He said, we've been there about 5 days. I said, I'm getting another show together. He said, why? Don't do that. Don't do that, Bobby Rush. Your show been great. If the people don't like it, change housing. Don't change your show. In other words, change building. In the wrong, you've been here too long or someplace else. So ever since then, I've been doing one-nighters, man.
Yeah. Well, how many, you have a regular touring band?
Oh, yeah, I have a regular touring band. I've had so many guys, musicians with me that that wasn't with me a long time ago, but I do have a drummer with me, been with me 37 years. Have a bass man, been with me 25 years. A keyboard player, been with me 23 years. And one been with me 20 years. And a couple of girls been with me 18 years. One been with me 12 years. The bass man, a new bass man, been with me 11 years. But yeah, I've been in and out of like a family. Then I had many guys who were with me before, not longer with me anymore, not longer living anymore. A lot of guys are come and gone. And God, like a Pine Top Perkin and, you know, and many, many other guys who not around with me anymore.
You were certainly a showman. What do people get when they head to a Bobby Rush show?
What they see is what you get. And I'm one of the few guys who left. And I'm so blessed to have this thing. I crossed over now to a white audience, but I haven't crossed out to a black audience. You know, I'm the one of the few guys who left.
Yeah.
Can go to a Memphis, Tennessee, I play on a Beale Street, and draw me 2,000 or 3,000 white audience. And I also can go across the railroad track with a black audience and draw 3,000 or 4,000 people in the black audience. And ain't many guys can do that. Well, Tyrone Davis and Johnny Taylor, people like that could do it on the black side, but
yeah.
The white owner didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
And I'm a blessed man to have a feet over here and a feet over there. I'm so blessed. I'm so thankful. Oh, God, I'm so thankful, you know? And who would ever thought that I'd be sitting down an interview with you and your background, where you come from, and what you do and what you love, and having a young lady that's done the engineering for us, and I know her background. I kind of check my background. I'm an old man, but I kind of Google my way through life, you know. So I don't go and think too blindfolded, and so I don't tell people about it until I get into business. I guess I got that from an early in my life. I remember my dad had 10 children. We lived on a farm, and he told me one day when I was about 12 years old, he says, "Junior, say I want you to jump out of school and help me with the other kids in school." He said, "You seem to be deaf enough to take care of yourself, you need to help me take care of the other children." Talking about his kids, those are my sister and brother. Yeah. He put me in a gin, what is gin? Cotton. And my job was, he said, "Now you go in the gin, and all I want you to do is bring me information." He said, "They're going to pay you $3 a week. $3 a week, man, all I would get." Mm-hmm. I had less than 10 cents an hour, you know. but I got $3 a week. He said, you get him information. The information he was talking about, the white guy was in talking about the Dow Jones, and black people didn't know what Dow Jones was.
Right.
Dow Jones mean they, whatever they were setting, the cotton, the beans, the peas, and the okra, tomatoes, whatever black people were raising. And they would tell around the table, they set the price. We're going to sell the beans for $2 a bushel, peas for 10 cents a bushel, whatever they're going to sell it for, they would talk it around the table. And then in the afternoon, when I get home, my dad would ask me, say, you get the news, boy? I said, yes, sir. He would, and my dad being the preacher, he would call his members up, get in touch with the members. Church service was 10 o'clock in the morning. He would have everybody meet him at 9:30, tell him what to sell, what not to sell for my information. Because I had a rag in my pocket and some sand in my pocket, and I would throw the rag in my pocket and throw the sand around the shoe so I could be wiping the white men's shoes so I could hear the information at the table. That's how I got the news. And I would take it to my father so he'd tell the black men what to say and what not to say.
Oh, man. Hey, let's talk about I Ain't Stun You, because it got used in that Eddie Murphy Dolemite movie and the biopic about Dolemite. And you are, I mean, you make a cameo in it as well.
But I Ain't Stun You is a slang coming from a black family, more or less, in the southern states. But when you say I ain't studying, that means I'm not thinking about you. I'm not doing what you say. Got this idea, because my mother used to cook little cakes, little tea cakes, we call them. And I would be in the kitchen with her, helping her cook them. So every time she would cook a few, she would let me taste one. But at the meantime, you got to understand, I got 9 more sisters and brothers. And I would be full by the time dinner got done. Then I would say, give me another one. I call my mother Mug. I would give me another one, Mug. She said, I ain't studying you, boy. I mean, that you had enough.
Yeah.
So that's where the sign come up. We're like, I'm not thinking about you. When someone tell you in my hometown, in my household, I ain't studying you, that means you don't ask no more. I'm not going to do nothing you say. I ain't studying you.
How did the song wind up in Dolemite Is My Name?
Because the same guy was doing it when did the chicken head with me with another movie he was doing, the several movie he had called me, but he was looking for the right song to do.
Yeah.
And someone had kind of beat me out every time politically because I didn't know him well enough to get inside, but he liked my song. So then they said, well, we need someone to play this part of this Southern soul part. So he mentions, I got a guy, Bobby Rush. He said, well, they got this song called Ain't Steady. At the meantime, when they had the song Ain't Studying, I had a spit publishing with the Malico Records.
Yeah.
So they asked me, said, well, Bobby Rush, we want to do this song, but we can't find the publishing of it, the guy who really owned it, the other half of his record. So we found a guy, but we can't even get in touch with him. See, all we got is name. I said, what's his name? His name is Emmett Ellis. They didn't know that was my real name. So I said, well, I think I can find him for you, but he's so expensive, man. He's hard to talk to. He wants a lot of money. He said, what kind of money do you think he wants? I said, let me talk to him about how much money he wants for this thing. But anyway, I negotiated, and my manager negotiated and got it done and got it all set. So I wanted, after I was there to do this, Ain't Studying You, the important part of this story, what I'm getting ready to tell you, I was so excited to meet Eddie Murphy. I went to meet him. I just knew it was work, but I never met him on a personal basis. I said to my management, I said, when Eddie Murphy get to the set today, I heard he's coming in. Please let me meet him because I just want to meet him. He felt the same way about me. When he came in, he stopped the whole set and ran and grabbed and hugged me.
Oh,
I'm in tears now. Now, he knows all about me. He knows all about what I do, what I've done. Oh, God. Man, I could have went through the floor. I never in my life felt so uplifted in heart. And I never get to tell him. Hopefully that I get to tell him how much he drove spirit back into me in my life.
She may be giving my love to my best friend Paul. But you can't miss what you can't measure, Paul. Sure can't get it all. If y'all think I'm gonna leave my woman, cause what somebody said,
Well, did you ever do a gig with Rudy Ray Moore?
No, I only did about 212. I did over 200 things. Rudy traveled with me for many, many years all across the southern state. The last show I did with him was in Alabama, Pritchett, Alabama. They call it Pritchett, right out of Mobile. We used to play at the Harlem Duke Club all the time, two or three times a year. He would had this old bullhorn. He would come in town. He would open the show for me. I was the band, he was the MC, but he was a hustler. He would go in town, get on the hood of his car, have somebody driving. He would sit on the hood of the car with the bullhorn. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to be at such and such a club with Bobby Rush, and I'm the headliner, I'm the MC. And he would use these dirty words. He was cussing, talk nasty. And Rudy Ray Moore is opening the show. If you never heard Rudy Ray Moore, you won't get out the door and talk to rhyme all things up, you know.
Yeah.
And then Bobby Rush is Hoochie Man. But I'm the man who made love to the Hoochie Man. He would talk all kind of trash, you know. you know what I'm talking about, you know. Eat it. He's the Dolly Mac, but I'm the one made the Dolly Mac, you know. He's the bomb, but I made the bomb.
Well, so you did all this, spent all this time with Rudy Ray Moore. Did you turn around and tell Eddie, did you give him any pointers on playing Rudy Ray Moore?
No. What they did with me, because I messed up again. I believe, I don't know if it's you, somebody told me later, Robert Rush, they had a slot for me for two or three days to do what I was going to do.
Yeah.
They allowed me for mistakes, you know, so I had two or three day window so I could get it right, you know, like shooting.
Yeah.
But now I said, I told myself, I don't want to mess this up because I want it so bad. It's a chance for me to get on the movie. So the guy told me what they wanted me to do. So I kind of rehearsed to the point where I wouldn't make it a mistake. I did this man in two or three takes. The guy said, you got it. We got it, man. I nailed it. In a couple of hours, man, I just nailed the part, nailed the song down, and the whole bit with another band never saw before. Because I knew where I was going and what I was doing, you know?
Right.
And
right.
The girl that went no rehearsal with them, I come down and did the stuff, man. And of course, now I could have made a little more money because they were paying me every day. I could have said, well, listen, messed up a little bit so I can make some more money tomorrow. But no, I got to be so good. I did it all in one day. I did it all in one day, so I cut my money short. But nevertheless, I loved it, and I hope I get a chance to do it again.
Oh, yes. So you mentioned going up to Chicago. Years ago, I rode with Bo Diddley from Athens, Georgia, where he had played a gig. And I was going to college at the time, and we brought Bo to play a show there at the university. And I rode with him to the airport the next day, and it was about an hour and a half ride. And he was talking the whole time about his life. And so it wasn't an interview, but he was just sharing his experiences, and it was, you know, phenomenal. But one thing he was talking about, and I want to ask you about, is he was talking about coming from the South to Chicago, and he was so much a boy, and how when he was going to school and stuff, the worst thing that one kid would call another kid is country. And that coming from the South, he was always being teased by the other kids. And there are a lot of folks there that would look down their nose, you know, black folks coming from the South, black folks already were from the North. Did you ever experience any of that when you?
Yeah. I think the saddest thing that I ever saw in my life, two of the saddest things, when they opened the B.B. King Club up in L.A., it's been 20, 30 years ago, whenever they opened it up, there was a black guy who was running the entertainment pod. So I was sitting at the door, getting ready to go on that night. I was at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Show didn't start at 9 o'clock, but I'm glad to be in LA because now I'm beginning to get some gigs and BB King to recommend me to this gig and don't want to let him down, don't want to let the house down. And I'm sitting at the door with my blue jeans on. He said, sir, are you from Mississippi? I said, yes, sir, I'm from Mississippi. He said, I'm still waiting on Bobby Rush. Do you know him? I said, yes, sir, I know him. He said, when he get here, let me know where he coming, because I know, he said, I know them guys, I'm Mississippi. probably got their shoes ran over. They ain't got no shoes on. He got boo-boo on his feet and cow boo-boo and whatever. And he looked at me and he went on back out. And I sat there for another couple hours. Then I went dressed and I dressed pretty well. And I went on stage and I did my show and I came back. He said, "Are you the guy who was sitting at the door early?" I said, "I don't know, sir. Depend on what door you're talking about." He said, "I was waiting on Bobby Rush. You Bobby Rush." He said, "I just looked at you on the stage, man. Damn, you good to be from Mississippi." From the southern state.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing we all got. If you're from the south, you're good to be from the south if you was good. If you're not, they wouldn't expect anything from you. I'm going to tell you what I did with this, my new record, Raw Than Raw. I picked some songs and some musicians, entertainers, song because the song itself, but I took it and made it my song.
Right.
I picked the kind of guy that never changed. Muddy Waters, to Jimmy Reed, to Bo Diller, B.B. King, a few guys. I couldn't do everybody, but I picked a few guys. Most guys, if he's from Louisiana, when he got to L.A., he kind of dealt with the L.A. in crowd, whatever they was doing, socialized with the guys, and he kind of changed to that. But you ever notice a guy from Mississippi, whenever he opened his mouth, you say, "Hey, that guy from Mississippi," because what you see is what you get. He never changed. That's why I want to do this guy. Because I looked up to these guys, man, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember when Muddy Waters was 28 years old, I believe, 28, 29. He was playing at a place called Cibio's in Chicago. I'm a young man. He wasn't 30 years old. Muddy Waters was so crazy about me. And I went to this party with him. And I supposed to have been there at 8 o'clock. I forgot his party, and I thought about it at 10:30, my wife. She said, "You going to Muddy Waters birthday party?" I said, "Oh, it's 10:30. I forgot." When I got to Lake Cibio's Lounge on Lake Street in Chicago, mm-hmm. Muddy Waters was hanging out the window looking out. He said, "Hey, Blood, man, I've been waiting on you, man. The party's over now, but come on around to the back. Come upstairs." I went upstairs where Muddy Waters was. He's 28, 29 years old. And he had the old ladies up there with him. They had to dress up. Boy, they was looking good, but they dressed well. They was old. I said, "How old are you?" One lady said, "I'm 29. The other lady said, "I'm 30. One lady was 34 or 35 years old. I sneaked out the back door and left Muddy Waters because the lady was too old. Oh, man. I think about that, man. Oh. How silly could I be? The lady 35 years old.
Well, that's, you know, it's different now. You're looking back, you know. But when
I'm like 18, 19 years old. Wasn't 20.
Right. Well, so this Grammy-nominated album, Raw Than Raw, it features you stripped down because guitar, foot stomping, harmonica playing. You got a really big discography now. Have you done stripped down recordings like these before, or is this the
first one? Yeah, I did. The first one, I call it Raw, and this is Raw Than Raw. I have several things in the can already I was doing. This is the way I write all the time. This is really me. It's easy for me to do this, man, because I can play like three or four guitar playing at one time. B.B. King told me once, "Man, if I could play like that, I wouldn't take a band with me. Because I can play and sing real like rub your head, pat your stomach. I can do a lot of things with the guitar, man, and keep singing and patting my feet, and feet going one way, fingers going another way, and the thumb on the guitar going another way." And I'm just blessed with that, man. Because that's where I was raised up. I didn't have a band in the house with me. I had a one string on a wall, man. I had to with this one string.
Is that what it's called? One string, the diddly bow, where you nail it?
Well, we didn't call it. We just called it a one string guitar. Okay. Later on, I found out they had a name, the diddly bow.
Well, so I want to make sure I'm understanding this right. So on the new record, I didn't see anybody else listed in the liner notes playing on there. It's you accompanying yourself on guitar.
Oh, no, with nobody. Just me. Just me.
Just you. Yeah, yeah.
And you know what, though, man? I only overdub a harmonica part. Yeah. Because sometimes the harmonica part, I don't like it around my neck. And I couldn't do all the harmonica around my neck. That's the only thing that's overdubbed, some part of the harmonica. Everything else is one take. It wasn't the same as, well, let me start over, let's do it again. If it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, it's wrong. That's one take, all this stuff.
So on the album, you've got a mix of your own tunes and covers by a number of these other greats. So you were talking about that. Specifically, you're doing that Howlin' Wolf, Smokestack Lightning, and Sonny Boy Williamson's Don't Start Me Talkin', A Honeybee That Muddy Waters Used to Do. I was wondering, when you were doing those specific songs from those specific artists, I mean, do those songs, do you really represent those specific people? I mean, do you see their personalities in that, those songs?
Yeah, I know them on a personal base, so I could see them, I could see me in them.
Yeah.
Doing these songs, I mean, because I know a lot, and I didn't try to copy the guy itself. I just tried to take the song and make it my song.
Right.
But I want to represent them inside of the song, you know.
Well, had you recorded any of these of your songs before, or are these new recording, new songs?
Oh, I had recorded them before. I got maybe, I may have 100 songs that I already recorded. I could put out 10 albums, but I go into the studio.
So I especially like Let's Make Love Again and Garbage Man. Out of the tunes of your own that are on the new album, well, Rawer Than Raw, what's your favorite?
Probably Garbage Man, because it's so it's relate to me so heavily. Because I would think, when I did Garbage Man, I would think about, what could I do that I could sing about would hurt me so bad I could laugh about?
Yeah.
And having someone to come to your house and steal your wife from you, that been coming to your house for the last 20 years, taking your garbage. And that's the main, got your woman and gone.
Yeah.
And that's a hurting situation, but it hurts so bad you have to laugh about it.
Right.
You know, out of mailman, insurance man, out of garbage man. I had three men to talk about: garbage man, mailman, and insurance man. Which one that would hurt my heart the most? Insurance man put it down. He may be dressed up a little bit. He may be smart together. You know, insurance man be the same thing. The mailman, same thing. But the garbage man, I would never thought she would leave with him. He'd be dirty, picking up everything but garbage.
Have you ever been mistreated by someone you showed enough love? Have you ever been mistreated by someone you showed enough love? Out of all the men my woman could have left me for, she left me for the garbage man.
You opened up the album with Down in Mississippi. So tell me about Down in Mississippi.
Down in Mississippi because Mississippi, not because I live here. Mississippi got a bad name for being the worst place in the world. I went to Chicago, first of all, because I thought I was going to find a better outlet for me as a black man and more freedom to do what I want to do as a blues man, as a black man.
Yeah.
But when I got there, J.B. Lenore and Muddy Water introduced me to Rock Island, that was a club in Blue Island. And he introduced me to this man who owned this club, was a white audience. And he get me a job there, and I was making $7 or something an hour. Muddy Water would come by there after he got me the gig and do a little guest thing for me for $5.50. But I was playing behind a curtain every night. But he wanted to hear my music, but they didn't want to see my face. It was a white audience.
Yeah.
So they had a curtain. But I got so good and so comfortable with it, so he would open the curtain up and let me take a bow and close the curtain right back up. But then the people kind of booed that because they could see the band. So yeah, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put the band behind a curtain and you behind another curtain. So when I open the curtain up, they won't see nobody but you. They accepted that. But they didn't want to see this black band. It opened up for about 4 or 5 seconds. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been entertained by Bobby Rush, Ojibwe. That's what it was. They opened the curtain up here, down, just that quick, closed it back up. And then my thought was, if I did this and played this club like that, but later on I got another job, almost the same way, but it was called the Bourbon Street, and it said no colored allowed on the door. No colored folks allowed. That was on the door. I played there for many years.
Well, man, there's, you know, a long way still to go, but you have seen a lot of change over the course of your life.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I saw a lot of change, but at my age, at the age of 70, when you analyze the change,
yeah,
more things have changed, Ro, more you remain the same.
Do you have any hope in your heart?
Yeah, I have hope in my heart, but you know what give me hope? Every time I, in my life, I have run into valleys. And something or somebody always come along, lift me out of my valleys to high hill. And I tell you today, you know what? During this interview with you, lift me out of my valley, because I've been in the valley now for about 11 months with this virus, couldn't go to work.
Right.
But this interview with you, your background of where you come from, what you're doing, and the people you're involved with, let me know that we all are in this thing together. Whether we black, white, green, brown, whatever, we're in this thing together. Somebody somewhere feel the same way I feel, that we all must live together, must have love for each other. You don't have to like me or love me, but just respect me. And I said all the time, you don't have to like my show or like my song, but if I'm good at what I do, this way I don't like old Bobby Rush, but damn, he good.
What about it? I hear that preacher's son in there still.
Well, I'm so blessed and so thankful, and I'm so lucky, and I'm trying to do everything I can, why I can, because when there come a time I cannot do, I won't regret what I did not do.
Bobby, I want to thank you so much today for joining me for our Coolest Conversations.
I'll be glad when this virus is over so I can come and just, hey, man, and give you a hug and shake your hand, man.
I so look forward to taking you up on that. But right now, we got to give that opening track, Down in Mississippi, a listen. It's Bobby Rush off Rawer Than Raw in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Been down in Mississippi and a show had a wonderful time. Been down in Mississippi and a show had a wonderful time. I got high, drinking that moonshine. You know my friend took me down on Bill Street. Seen everybody I wanted to meet. Down in Mississippi, sure had a wonderful time.
That was Bobby Rush doing Down in Mississippi, the opening track to his Grammy-nominated album, Rawer Than Raw, available from Deep Rush Records. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Bobby for being my guest today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And please join me again for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.